This is music from Charlie Hayden. Welcome to The Checkout, a podcast and radio show from WBGO. I'm Rhonda Hamilton. Charlie Hayden once said, "Wouldn't the world be a better place if everyone had great ears?" Well, today, we listen to him and remember one of the world's greatest bass players. It's my conversation with Hayden from 1997. Mostly other people do the killing, says bassist Mappa Elliott. That's the name of his band. They appear at this weekend's Newport Jazz Festival. We speak to them, plus interview the festival's grandmaster, George Ween. The impresario tells us the music he's most looking forward to for the festival's special 60th anniversary with WBGO's Tim Wilkins. This is The Checkout. I'm your special guest host, Rhonda Hamilton. Thanks for checking in.
George Ween, when did the love of music first enter your life?
I had a band, like kids have rock bands in their cellar. I had a 13-piece band when I was 14 years old. We called all the kids in the neighborhood who could play trumpets and trombones, and we had the stock arrangements of In the Mood and Tuxedo Junction. And then I got involved with improvisation. I heard the small bands, and I said, this is what I'm interested in. The next thing I know, it became a total direction in my life. Father Hines was a big influence on me because of a piano teacher I had by the name of Sam Sachs in Boston, who was a devotee of Father Hines. I also studied with Teddy Wilson back during my college years. And then you get involved in other directions as jazz takes different directions. So I play a little differently now.
George Ween, indulge me for a minute and take me back to Newton, Mass, and a young boy, 12, 11 maybe, sitting there looking at a pile of Blue Label records on the table, picking through them, maybe putting one on to play. What did you hear and what did that moment do for you?
Hearing Louis Armstrong play the Saints Go Marching In, I guess. It was a hit then, it's still a hit now. But there were so many things here, listening to Benny Goodman with a trio, with Ted, with a clarinet and piano and drums. They then Duke Ellington, when I first heard him, and then the Basie Band, 1 o'clock Jump, and all of those things are embedded in my memory, and listening to Sing, 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 and all of those records, and that's still my first loves. You never lose that, but you can't just live with those records.
What is it about jazz that excites the soul? What is that essence which can get someone, and often at a George Ween Festival, this is something I always love. There's always a moment that gets people up out of their seats and dancing.
You know, it's interesting that you ask that question because I think a lot of it has to do with the individual. Seeing that jazz is such an individualistic music, maybe the person who listens to it wants to be an individual. He just doesn't want to go along with the crowd. And I think that that is part of the appeal of jazz, that you feel that you have your own ability and your own tastes in digesting this music that is being presented to you. You're not just going along because every kid in the neighborhood is going there. And you're a little different. I know I always felt that when I was in high school, way, way back in the early 40s and late 30s. I mean, I felt I was different from my other friends. They didn't like jazz. I liked jazz. That music that they were listening to has disappeared. The music that I liked is still active in my head and still here. So I think that's part of it.
So there's an element of finding yourself, finding a deeper identity and bringing that out?
I think so. And I would like to see a little more of the social life involved with jazz. And that's what's sort of happening at Newport. Because with the three stages, people are running around from stage to stage to see what's happening. And there's an excitement in the air and a feeling of vibrancy that catches with the musicians. They feel it. As they're coming to their sets and as they get ready to play, they feel the atmosphere in the air. And it's very moving and it reaches you. Jazz Festival right now is an attempt to establish that jazz is a music that will continue. As the great players pass away, the young ones come along, and there's so much young talent out there that it's unbelievable, and we're enjoying putting new artists on it, along with, of course, the Herbie Hancocks and the Wayne Shorters, and now there are other kids coming along, and so you have to give them a stage and make the world aware that there are these brilliant young artists, and even if they don't know their names, they've got to learn their names and learn their music. And it's all a transitional period right now. Jazz will never die as long as the people want to play it, and eventually the people will be listening to it.
Who are some of those young artists who've caught your ear and who you've tried to encourage as you can?
There are so many of them. I mean, you know, I don't care whether it's a Darcy James Argyll, who is a brilliant musician, who has yet to build a public for his music, which is unique. You can go on and on and on. And Gregory Porter is going to be a star, and who is in the jazz roots and jazz tradition. I call them emerging artists. There are two types of emerging artists. They're the ones that are creative and contemporary. They're ones that come from the roots of jazz but are becoming popular, like a Jonathan Batiste who comes right out of the roots of the music. But people hear him. They love him. He has the ability to communicate. Thank you. a lot of jazz musicians don't realize that no matter how great an artist you are, you have to communicate. If you want to use the word communicate, as change it to entertain. That's part of your responsibility. When Picasso painted a painting, when he reached his zenith in his style, he painted what the people wanted to see. And that's why so many people, they go through different periods and different styles, and they reach their identity. Musicians have to find their identity. And when they find their identity, the public finds their identity. And once people identify with a musician, then he's popular the rest of his life. And so a lot of them have not searched for it. I mean, people like Ellington searched for their sound. Basie searched for his sound for his band. They worked at it. They worked at it. My sound must be my sound. It must not be somebody else's sound. And that I don't hear that in a lot of young musicians. Miguel Zenon, with his Puerto Rican background, I mean, he's fantastic. I heard him in Puerto Rico once, and the people were cheering and yelling and at his music because he communicated to them in a way that they understood.
George Wein, jazz has grown and expanded in some ways, it seems, in every direction. Is jazz more of a family or less of a family now than it once was?
I think it is, believe it or not, more of a family. I think, see, the jazz has become part of the educational system. Every school has jazz musicians on their faculty. We tried something this year that destroys the myth that young people aren't interested in jazz. There is a myth that young people are only interested in rock and roll. And we put tickets on sale at Newport for students at $20. Now, this is an $80 ticket, and we're selling it for $20. We sold 2,000 tickets to students. It was fantastic. It brought a breath of fresh air to the festival. I went down to hear John Zorn's marathon. I stayed there for an hour and a half. I heard some fantastic music. Different groups, totally organized. Supposed to be freedom. Each set was organized. John directed each thing. The musicians, when they played with freedom, but there was order in the freedom. It was fascinating to see. A lot of people love his music. Others don't like his music. I enjoyed it that night. You can't live in the past. It's not what you have done in life that counts. It's what are you doing that counts. And it's very easy to sit back and say, well, man, I did this and I did that. I mean, I did a lot in my life. But it has meaning in only what it relates to what you're doing today. The experience I've earned, the experience I've gained through winning and losing over the years helps me now. But it's all part of a great scene that is going on. Hey, it keeps me going. It keeps my life complete. It keeps me happy.
That's John Zorn's Masada. He'll be featured at this year's Newport Jazz Festival in a John Zorn marathon concert. George Wein will also feature some of his other favorite artists, Darcy James Argue, Gregory Porter, Miguel Zenon, and Jonathan Baptiste. See the full lineup at newportjazzfest.org. WBGO's Tim Wilkins spoke to the impresario. Coming up next in this Newport Jazz Fest preview, mostly other people do the killing, with our producer, Simon Rentner. This is The Checkout. I'm Rhonda Hamilton.
Mappa Elliott, Ron Stabinski. Thank you for joining us on The Checkout. The band is called Mostly Other People Do the Killing. And you're here to tell us this actually pretty somber, tragic tale of a band from Pennsylvania in the early 20th century that inspired you to do music for this project. Please tell us this story.
So there was this town in western Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh, called Red Hot. And it was kind of like a coal mining boom town, founded in the late teens. It's about 30 miles north of Pittsburgh, so at that point that was far enough to kind of constitute a separate cultural center. A lot of musicians came through that area at that time. Jelly Roll Morton was on tour out there at least twice in the late 20s, early 30s. Louis Armstrong came through, multiple other people. Anyway, so there's this group of kids, they would have been, you know, in their 20s, who formed a band called the Brimstone Corner Boys. And they didn't really have a lot of models to go on in terms of how to play jazz at that time, because in, you know, the late 20s, early 30s, especially in moderately rural Pennsylvania, you didn't have a whole lot of access to other musicians who were playing in this style. So these guys kind of pieced together a way of playing jazz in the late 20s and early 30s from what they could, you know, pick up hearing people play live. And it wound up being very stylistically strange and inconsistent and lots of anachronisms. And then the town was destroyed in a mining disaster, and we're only left with a little bit of sheet music that we and most of the other people do the killing have painstakingly tried to reconstruct in the 21st century.
This very tragic tale in which a whole town was decimated by a mining accident. How many people died from this accident?
I have no idea, but we can go with many. And, you know, mining accidents like that were not uncommon at all in western Pennsylvania at that point. I mean, coal mining is not exactly a safe enterprise, so to have any town...
normally doesn't wipe out a musical style in the process.
It normally does not wipe out a musical style in the process, but do we have any way of knowing, really?
So then everybody was dancing to this red-hot music. Do some historians speculate that they were actually doing the shick shinny shimmy before they went up in flames?
It would all be speculation, but that seems plausible. The only reason the musical records were, not also destroyed was they happened to have been left in Pittsburgh when they went down to play a gig down there. So nothing from the town is extant at this point. Thank you.
The Shikshini Shimmy. The Shikshini Shimmy.
Yes.
Mappa Elliott. Ron Stabinski. Mostly Other People Do the Killing. That is a dance, right?
It could be. I don't see why it would not be. Although, you know, I can imagine someone having a great deal of difficulty doing any dance to the way we play those tunes. But it's possible.
I agree.
Yeah.
We can safely say and tell our audience that this story that you've been telling about people tragically dying in this coal accident or mining accident is fictitious. So
true, but... You know, I'm sure a whole lot of people, you know, met similar fates in that part of the world. So it's not specific fiction. When I was checking out this town of Red Hot, just because the name is so great, it's listed on these registries of Pennsylvania ghost towns. So the thing with Red Hot is that, from what I can tell, it never actually was a town in the first place. It's one of these places that kind of happened fairly frequently in Pennsylvania, where they planned on building a town there, and they named the place, and then nothing ever happened. And so there's a spot on the map called Red Hot where there is not now, nor was there ever anything, which creates a situation where, okay, so if there's a place that has a name but no history, then that's the easiest place to make up fake history for, because you don't have any, you know, reality getting in the way. So if I was going to concoct a story about, you know, musicians trying to create some bizarre style of, you know, postmodern jazz in the 1920s, what better place to do it than in the middle of nowhere where there's, you know, no reality to get in your way. But all the stuff about Jelly Roll Morton going through there is true. Louis Armstrong, all that stuff is legit. Those guys were on tour. Jelly Roll Morton went through there with his band, the Red Hot Peppers, at least twice. And then I think he went through there a couple other times in the late 20s with a minstrel show. So anyone living in that area could very well have heard both Armstrong and Morton at that time. And so, yeah, when I'm writing these stories, I kind of like versions of history that could have happened but didn't. And would be very interesting had they actually happened. And that's kind of the way we're trying to make music, creating these alternate musical realities, hopefully.
Mappa Elliott joins us on the checkout. Mappa, that's a strange name your parents gave you.
My parents did not give me such a terrible name, or they would be bad parents. But my actual first name is Matthew, and the year I was born, that was the most popular name for boys in the United States. And so in the tiny little town that I grew up in, there were three other Matthews in my first grade class. So Mappa was a nickname bestowed upon me when I was about 12, and it avoided confusion, so it stuck.
And your band is called Mostly Other People Do the Killing.
It is.
And
it almost looks like it could be an acronym of your name.
It does, but it's not.
Total
coincidence.
More cosmic affirmation.
Yep, right there, yeah.
What was the first cosmic affirmation?
At this point, I don't even remember. I mean, there have been a lot.
Ron Stabinski, you were you're actually from Pennsylvania.
That's true. That is one of the major...
I am. It's actually a requirement. Someone in the band needs to live in Pennsylvania.
Right.
It's in my contract.
It's true.
And is it the sort of anonymity of the place that sort of attracts you to sort of reinvent yourself in the music?
The Pennsylvania thing?
Yeah.
No. I decided that I wanted some arbitrary way to name all my compositions so that the compositions and titles would have absolutely no relationship with each other. And Pennsylvania is full of interesting town names, so I decided to title all my songs with random, interesting Pennsylvania town names. But, it prevents me from having to, spend time coming up with titles. So.
Including the song King of Prussia. No, probably not.
King of Prussia is a town outside Philadelphia that used to have the largest mall in the United States until it was surpassed by whatever that thing in Minnesota is with the roller coaster inside.
I don't even know about that.
I bet you don't. That's some other stuff right there.
And you're featured on this track, Ron, especially in the beginning. Am I hearing you quote Joe Jackson?
You know, it's funny because that is the quote that seems to get the most attention. Almost every review I've read.
And honestly, I didn't know that tune before you played it. And,
stepping out. How do you not know that tune?
I guess it's a gap in my knowledge. But, I did not know that tune until everyone started bringing up the fact that Ron quotes that tune at the beginning of King of Prussia. And actually, I'm pretty sure I still have never listened to the Joe Jackson version. So in my head, all I got is, I know what they're talking about. It's got to be this one thing. But I'm going to kind of preserve that so that someday I can go back and listen to it afresh.
I remember stepping out when I was on the radio. I loved that song on the radio.
Hey.
One of those things. I finally, after all those years, it was pent up inside me.
You know, it's funny, too, because after hearing it the first time and then revisiting it, your whole cadenza or solo sort of leads up to the Joe Jackson.
Right. That harmonic vibe is established right from the very beginning. But it's funny because that was not intentional. That's just kind of how I play. So I guess my whole life I never realized how influenced I was as a child by hearing Joe Jackson stepping out until that very moment in the studio. It was a revelation.
Right, preserved for all time.
The King of Prussia.
I am the King of Prussia. Thank you.
recording is called Red Hot, and the band, Mostly Other People Do the Killing. Mappa Elliott, as a person that enjoys writing, have you ever studied the etymology of killing in the lexicon of jazz music?
Certainly not academically. that word does get bandied about quite a bit in our circles, usually with the G dropped. The band name is a phrase taken verbatim from an interview.
What interview?
It's a nice group. It's an interview with Leon Theremin,
yes,
who is the inventor of the instrument of the same name. He was a Russian scientist. He invents the theremin in 1919, and Lenin comes to power and sends him off touring Europe, displaying Soviet musical and scientific ingenuity, and all is right and wonderful with the world until Stalin comes to power. And then Stalin realizes that here's this guy who's maybe seen a little too much of the West and happens to know how to make electronic equipment and could therefore be useful. So he gets thrown in jail. This is Leon Theremin. And Stalin has him for, you know, the rest of his life and then onward building spy equipment. All these really high-tech, mid-century...
Required no power source of its own.
Self-powered, yeah. So
that genius guy.
Yeah, total genius guy. But so he's, you know, presumed dead circa late 1970s. And then there was an electronic music convention in New York in, I think, 1981. And he showed up. And nobody had seen this guy in 60 years. And he sat down to do an interview, and he's pretty out of it at the time. He's 80-something. And so in this interview, it gets to the point where they ask him about Stalin, and they're like, so what was it like, you know, being imprisoned, living under Stalin? And his response is, if I get the wording right, Stalin wasn't really so bad. Mostly other people did all the killing. So it's like that mostly in there is really great, and I kind of just thought of it as this, like, you know, interesting, ironic group of words that made for a good band name.
Oh, and the MOP, that's the other cosmic affirmation.
And that's the other cosmic affirmation.
MOPA, M-O-P-D-D-K.
Right. So my friends do call me MOP, and that is the first three letters of the acronym. The unpronounceable acronym.
MOP. Did you get that in stereo?
Yeah, I think so. We can pan that later.
Mostly Other People Do the Killing. Coming up next, Charlie Hayden and Me, a conversation from 1997. This is The Checkout. I'm Rhonda Hamilton. Charlie Hayden died on July 11th, 2014. In his seven-decade career, he was a principal figure in shaping the music's history and playing with many of its all-timers, including Ornette Coleman, Pat Metheny, Paul Bley, Carla Bley, and many others. In 1997, I interviewed the bassist. In that conversation, we talked about some of his historic collaborations, plus what it was like growing up in America's heartland with a musical family. At the time of this interview, he was celebrating a homecoming, Beyond the Missouri Sky, a recording with Pat Metheny. It would later win a Grammy Award. You're originally from Iowa, isn't that right?
Originally from Shenandoah, Iowa. Mm-hmm. My family had a radio show there when I was born, and when I got to be about 2 years old, my mom... When I started humming harmony with her when she was rocking me to sleep, she said, it's about time for me to go on the show, you know. So I started on the show there, and then we moved to Missouri. We moved to Springfield and continued our radio shows there. And, I'm a Missourian. A lot of, you know, Missouri is great for music. Jimmy Blanton was from there. Miles Davis, Charlie Parker. So I like being from Missouri.
You brought up Jimmy Blanton, and in introducing you, we speak about your role in making the bass a more prominent voice in music. Was Jimmy Blanton an early influence on you?
He was. I heard his duets when I was in high school.
With Duke Ellington.
With Duke Ellington. And they just amazed me that a young bass player, as young as he was, I think he was 18 or 19 when Duke hired him, the story... Duke's band was playing in St. Louis, and they went to a jam session afterwards, some of the guys in the band, and they heard Jimmy Blanton play and went over to the hotel and woke Duke Ellington up and said, "You got to come and hear this kid play." And he came to the session and hired Jimmy Blanton on the spot. He was the first bassist to really bring out the instrument to a solo instrument's level, you know, and it's amazing to think, I mean, the guy was a genius, and he died very young, very tragic ending to his life. He was like 21 or 22 when he died in L.A. of tuberculosis. Back then they called it consumption. They had no medicine to combat it back then, you know, and so he died in L.A. by himself. His family wasn't with him, and Milt Hinton told me that he was in L.A. at the time this happened, playing with Cab Calloway's band, and he bought Jimmy a radio to play, put at his bedside, and they dedicated a song to him every night, and he was with him when he took his last breath. I mean, can you imagine being 21 years old by yourself in L.A. in a big city and not having a family? The guy was an amazing bass player, and the sound that he got, he really paid attention to getting the most beautiful sound out of his instrument, you know, which a lot of young musicians today forget how important that is, you know. So he was a big influence on me.
Let me go back to Missouri. You say it's a great place for music, and in looking at this material for the album Beyond the Missouri Sky, I noticed that Pat Metheny says that Missouri is a great place to dream in particular.
Yeah.
Is that, I imagine those big open skies really kind of lend itself to letting your mind go and think creatively.
We both identified with that concept of dreaming when you're a kid about going to the big city. Being from a rural area all my life, which is good in a way, because I was surrounded with Roy Acuff and the Delmore Brothers and the Carter family, which was a big influence on me musically and my early musical training. I'm self-taught, but I had a lot of musical discipline in my early life, singing every day on the radio, learning how to sing every harmony part by ear. That was my musical training. It's like going to school, you know. But I always longed for the city. I used to draw pictures of skyscrapers in my art classes in grade school, and my teachers would get real upset. They said, "Charlie, can't you draw a pasture or a mountain or some flowers? Or do you always have to draw cities?" And so I started drawing cities at night. I used to stand in front of the mirror with my dad's raincoat and hat and dream about walking down Broadway in New York and listening to Bird and Jazz at the Philharmonic. But I'm really lucky to be from a rural area. And it was a big influence on my life being from Missouri. And we used to dream, you know, about leaving. And Pat felt the same way, and that's how we came up with this title of the record.
Mm-hmm. Well, people often refer to a Midwestern kind of mentality or mindset. What is that?
Well, it's the heartland, you know. It's mid-America. In music, the composers that really captured it in classical music were Aaron Copland and Charles Ives, people like that. And I think in jazz, one of the guys that really captured it is Pat Metheny. He captures that he has the ability and a special gift to describe and play the sound of Mid-America in his music in a way that all listeners are attracted to it, and still it retains the depth and beauty of great improvising musicians. His intervals and the voicings of his chords and the melodies that he plays when he composes, when he writes, and also when, the melodies he plays when he improvises. It just evokes the wide open spaces, and you know, this is like a pioneering country, and people from all over the world came to the United States, and jazz, the music that comes from this country, could only, I think, have been born in this country because it's of the special qualities and the innovation and the spontaneity of improvisation that go into the art form.
Well, you and Pat have been friends really for a long time, haven't you? You go back a ways, and people maybe not realize how close you are. He was your best man at your wedding.
He was the best man at my wedding in 1989, and at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, as a matter of fact. We've known each other. I met him first at a concert I was playing with Ornette Coleman at the University of Miami, and in 1973, opposite Charlie Mingus, and Pat was going to school at University of Miami, and then I think he started teaching there. And he was in the first row of at the concert with along with Jaco Pastorius and Bruce Hornsby and other people, and he came up to me after the concert and introduced himself. And then we used to run into each other over the years when I was working with Keith Jarrett's quartet on tour, and he was with Gary Burton, and we would talk. And then he called me one day to make his this album called 8081, and we've been close friends ever since.
That was an album where we played a lot of Ornette's music.
Yeah,
had the other members out of the Old and New Dreams band, right?
Yeah,
Dewey Redmond.
Yeah, Dewey was on the record, and over the years we played, we recorded albums together like Rejoicing, and I'm on some of his group records like Secret Story, and I introduced him to Ornette, and we did an album called Song X on Geffen, which was a great record.
Thank you.
That's Mob Job from Pat Metheny's Song X with Ornette Coleman, Jack DeJohnette, DeNardo Coleman, and Charlie Hayden. We're remembering bassist Charlie Hayden on this edition of The Checkout. We continue our conversation from 1997 as Hayden discusses his early collaboration with Paul Bley and Ornette Coleman. Pianist Paul Bley, you guys go back a long ways. To what, to the 1950s, early
1957, 58. We were playing at a club called the Hillcrest in Los Angeles, and that's about the same time I met Ornette, and then I got Ornette on the gig, Ornette and Don Cherry and Billy Higgins, and at the same time, Ornette's quartet with Don and Billy and I were rehearsing during the day to make our first albums on Atlantic and getting ready to go to New York to open at the Five Spot. But yeah, Paul Bley and I go back a long ways. Also reunited after 30 years at the Montreal Jazz Festival in 1989. I had him play with me, and I put the concert out. Two of the concerts have been released. They did a tribute for me at the Montreal Festival in 89, and I played seven or eight different nights with different people, and eventually all of them are going to be released, I hope. The first one that's come out was the concert with Don Cherry and Ed Blackwell, and they're all going to be called the Montreal Tapes. And the second one that came out was with Paul Bley and Paul Motion. The next one that's going to be released will be the Liberation Music Orchestra.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Liberation Music Orchestra, because that's something that you you organized with Carla Bley.
That's right.
Right, yep. Back in 1968, 69.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a band with a mission. I mean, you had a certain concept. Well, why don't you talk about that a little bit and how that came
It was recorded during the Vietnam War, and everybody was upset that we were involved in that, and a lot of things had happened that really were disturbing to me, you know, Martin Luther King's assassination and Bobby Kennedy and Che Guevara, and there was a lot of protests going on campuses all over the country, and the Chicago Convention had just happened, and a lot of people were beaten and arrested by the Chicago police, and I just felt real strongly at the time that I wanted to voice my concerns about the direction the country was going in, and I'm not really involved in politics per se, but I felt that with my music I could voice my concerns, and so I had some music from the Spanish Civil War that I had had for a long time that was really beautiful music that was played during the Spanish Civil War by the people in the Spanish Republic in 1937, and I could envision great jazz musicians being inspired by this music and improvising on this music. And so I called Carla and played it for her, and she loved it, and we both wrote some songs and recorded the first album, and it was really a wonderful experience. Thank you.
Well, the next piece we're going to hear is that song, Precious Jewel, which you said is something that the Delmore brothers used to sing. And you said that they were really a very significant influence on you. How so?
On my harmonies. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my dad was really strict with us, my brothers and sisters and I, when we were singing. We had to be perfect in our intonation and learn how to sing all the harmony parts by ear. And there were two guys, the Delmore brothers, that were singing this unbelievably beautiful harmony.
May the angels have peace, God bless her in heaven. They've broken my heart and they left me to roam.
And this was back in the early 30s and late 30s and early 40s. And they influenced a lot of country music, and I know they influenced a lot of bluegrass music with their harmonies. And they made a big impression on me because I hear their harmonies in music. You know, I got music going in my head all the time, but I mean, they really were a big influence in my harmonic concept. They also influenced the Carter family. And you know, Roy Acuff wrote this song, and he was a great country musician, and back then they called it hillbilly music, now they call it country and western, but that's when it was really pure back in the old days.
Mm-hmm. So we go back to that inspiration for the Precious Jewel.
Way back in the hills, when a boy I once wondered, buried deep in the grave lies the girl that I love. She was called from this earth, a jewel from heaven, more precious than diamonds, more precious than gold.
It's funny that you don't sing on your recordings, you don't do that. You gave that up?
I used to sing. When I was 15, Ron, I developed bulbar polio when they had this polio epidemic in Omaha, Nebraska. We were doing TV there with my family, and it paralyzed the left side of my face and my throat and my vocal cords, and I lost the range, you know, in my voice. But I used to sing. I love singing. My kids sing. They sing great.
Charlie Hayden died on July 11, 2014, in Los Angeles, from the degenerative effects of the post-polio syndrome of his youth. He was 76. His son and triplet daughters perform music to this day. This is one of Charlie Hayden's last recorded performances, with Keith Jarrett from 2007. Goodbye, from Last Dance. The Checkout is a podcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes and stream our show from our website at checkoutjazz.org. We are on Twitter at checkoutjazz. Our producer, Simon Rettner, is on Twitter too. Follow him at Simon Rettner. Thanks to Tim Wilkins and our operations staff at Jazz 88, Jay Sterone and David Tallickson. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Rhonda Hamilton. Thanks for listening.